Hello and Happy New Year, and welcome to episode 124 of the Crate and Crowbar PC Gaming Podcast. I'm Marsh Davis, and I'm joined this evening by Tom Francis.
Hello.
And very special guest, an AI maven, Mike Cook.
Hello.
And you're not just an AI maven, you're also a proc gen maven, aren't you?
Sure.
And a coding wizard.
Well, yes, those words. Someone has described me in those words before. It was you earlier today, but yeah, absolutely, yeah.
As an expert in these fields, how was 2015 for you? Was it a good year for AI in games? Was it a good year for proc gen in games?
I think it was a good year for proc gen in games. I think games are increasingly unafraid to branch out a little bit when it comes to proc gen, I think.
We should probably just mention that proc gen is procedural generation.
We should. I make that all the... In academia, they just abbreviate it to PCG, and I just walk around all day, just assuming people will know what that means. It's really bad.
Extra confusing if you used to work at PC Gaming.
I think it was a pretty good year. And I think developers, like I say, developers are branching out into new, tastier areas, tastier things to generate. So Ultima Ratio Regum, which I think has come up on the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Graham's a big fan.
Right. And so Mark Johnson, who I'm now delighted to say I'm actually working with, he's at the University of York doing research on a project called the DC Hub. And he's the developer of Ultima Ratio Regum. And that game does really nice stuff because it's generating things like cultural objects. Like, I think he wants to generate languages and accents and stuff that you don't normally necessarily go to. It's not just more dungeons. It's things which are a bit harder to evaluate, and they have a bit more meaning to players, which is quite exciting. I think that kind of thing's quite cool.
It generates like sigils and stuff, doesn't it? Sort of like individualized logos for
coats of arms, for guilds,
and those are all absurdly in depth.
Yeah, and he's very good at balancing the trickery. So he likes to add in hand-coded things, and he likes to blur over the edges between what's generated and what's hand-coded, which I think is very clever. So you begin to see the patterns in some parts of the game, and I think that tricks you into thinking that those same patterns are present elsewhere. And then when he throws in like a hand-generated ritual in a religion, you think, wow, this generator must be incredible. There's so much stuff. And of course it is incredible, but there's also, you know, he's really helping you get over this problem that a lot of gamers have, where they've seen behind the curtain so many times that they can't unsee it now.
Mm, yeah.
I think he's helping push back against
that. I should steal this idea.
Yes.
I think desert golfing deserves a mention for, for tricking or confusing the issue as to whether it's procedural generation or not, because I've heard so much argument from both sides of that. Like, some people think it's all completely handmade, and some people think it's all completely generated, and then a lot of people think it's some kind of mix, but no one's quite sure about which levels are fixed and which ones aren't.
That game has done an amazing job of fucking with me, like, on exactly that basis. I'm never sure where that hand of the designer is in play or not, and not just in terms of the actual levels themselves, which I go back and forth on whether they've all been just procedurally generated or not, because there was a run of, I don't know, 60 or so holes in the mid 2000s, they're funny to play because they upset your expectations in ways which you haven't encountered before. Like, you just think, oh, I know what will happen if I do that, and it doesn't quite happen. And not only does it not happen, but it completely undoes all the stuff that you'd done to get to that point. Yeah. And I don't know if that's just, you know, if you play enough thousands of holes at it, you will encounter these things. But it's made me very paranoid now. I also wonder if the game fucks with the friction and gravity at any point. Because, you know, when there was an artificial ending in that game, he introduced a hole which was impossible to pot. I don't know if that's the correct golfing term. Probably isn't. I don't play a lot of golf, but every time you fired a ball towards it, it would just miss. And
I fired my ball, but I didn't manage to pot it. Curse this game.
Yes, and
it was not a goal.
But because that's been introduced, even though he's carried on making levels and made that so you can pot that bowl.
Pot that bowl. That's a golfing.
It's made me paranoid now that whenever I just miss a shot, I think, well,
yeah,
maybe
physics itself is fucking with me.
Well, maybe he's working towards an average. Like, he knows what kind of average number of putts it takes to pot a bowl in desert golfing.
Good.
And he just makes it so that every now and again really good players will fuck up a bunch of shots and maybe helps bad players make lucky pots. I don't know.
I think you're spot on, actually. I think there have been times where it feels like the game has wanted to give me the satisfaction of potting or putting or scoring.
Putting to the pot.
Or particularly getting a hole in one just right. Like the bounces just go just right. But I think what's interesting about that game for people who are obsessive about it, certainly like you're kind of a god to me because you've gone further in it than even I bothered to. And even people think I probably spent too much time in that game, but
I've just spent a lot of time on the toilet this last year. That's what it says, really.
Yeah, it's good, but So in a way, it's, you know, the law of large numbers. They're not massive numbers, you know, a few thousand holes, but eventually you are going to see a certain level that has a property, or you're going to fire a certain shot that has a certain quality to it. And so you think, well, actually, maybe this isn't that rare. Maybe I just think it's standing out, but that's how it gets you, because you can't be sure either way, can you? And like, there'll be a level will generate where a full strength shot, will just not be far enough to get up this cliff. And you think, surely that's not random. He's intentionally put that there so that we can't get it in one shot. But then you think, well, eventually it would generate a level that did that. Or maybe the algorithm's designed to generate levels that screw with you. So it's just, that's why I love playing the game. One of the reasons why I keep playing it is because it makes you think about what procedural generation even is for. because maybe they are all hand generated. Maybe he just spent years of his life making 8,000 levels or however many there are.
2015's hottest PC game, Desert Golfing.
sorry about that. Yes, back to PC though. What about 2016? You mentioned a game off pod to me earlier that was...
Well, continuing this theme of games generating things that are a little bit different, I'm quite looking forward to Moon Hunters, which is by Kit Fox Games, I believe.
Moon Hunters.
Mm. I hope that is the name of the game.
Time of day or the planet?
Moon, as in the satellite orbiting Earth or whatever it's called. And that's a game that tries to generate a sort of mythology around what the player does, I believe. I hope I'm not overpromising things that the game doesn't do, but I believe that it takes your actions in the game world. You play a kind of hero in the age of myths and legends, and you're going and slaying beasts and deciding whether or not to help these little villages, and your decisions become written into this tome of beautiful stories and myths and legends yourself. So you're kind of helping procedurally annotate and generate these legends about a world and its people. And I think that's really cool. And I think when you look at the history of procedural generation, a lot of the early stuff that was dealt with in games is stuff that is very data-centric and it's black or white. And a level in Spelunky, not that Spelunky is an early example, but, you know, a level in Spelunky, caves are either solid or they're empty space, or they've got treasure in or they don't have treasure in. And the game doesn't need to know what treasure is or what a cave is or what a spider is. Like, it doesn't need to know anything about those things. It doesn't have to have watched Indiana Jones to understand that. Whereas when we start generating stuff that's a bit kookier and a bit more interesting, I think, first of all, it's a lot more interesting to talk about and to do as a developer. But also, you start to create games that can do a bit more. They can start to play with culture as a game mechanic, or they can start to play with like human emotions or senses as a game mechanic. And I think that's really cool. I think that's beginning to expand what we think about procedural generation for. Because I think it's actually starting to get a bad rap, I think, procedural generation. People are starting to feel a bit negative towards it, I think. I don't know how you guys feel about that.
It can be used badly, can't it? This is the advantage of putting in handmade stuff every now and again, because one of the weaknesses of procedural generation is that it can be used to create a lot of stuff that feels generic or lacking in meaning. And you can bring back that meaning, because meaning is often in the eye of the beholder. So if you produce stuff which does seem to have overt authored meaning to it, then players will impose meaning that isn't perhaps there on other stuff that has been procedurally generated. But I don't think that's a flaw of the technique. I think that's just every tool can be used badly, can't it?
Yeah, and I should stress, every time I've used procedural generation, it's always in this way of just generating stuff. Like, I use it in the ways that, because I still think that's fun, and I think it's fine. I think it's good, and I love games that do it. All the games I buy are like that as well. But I just hope that we can also do new things with it as well. And that's what I'm looking forward to next year.
You are working on a game with procedural generation in it?
Well, yes, I am, actually, which... right now is not been announced, which is a bit weird to talk about it. But by the time this podcast comes out, it will have been, which is even weirder. I'm working on a game called Rogue Process, and that has a lot of procedural generation in it.
Great lighting system.
I should also point out that I managed to trick someone into making it with me.
Who's that person in this room? Can you identify him to the
Tom. He is Tom. It's you. I haven't told you this. Just subconsciously. No, it is, of course, actually Marsh, isn't it? It's you. You're going to be helping me make it. You're going to be making it look beautiful.
Well, let's not make promises we can't take.
Well,
back.
It already looks beautiful. I'm very appreciative to have you on board. But that uses procedural generation all over the place, doesn't it? Which makes your life both a headache and more interesting.
It's been fascinating. I really enjoyed making tile sets for the purpose of procedural generation. Mm. In fact, we started making this game together before we collaborated on Proc Jam, where I did tile sets. And I think I made a lot of mistakes in making stuff for Rogue Process that I then managed to not fix, more or less, but I knew more of what I was doing in terms of like naming conventions for tiles so that you'd know how you could fit that together with what other tiles and stuff like that.
I just realized I think I've actually talked about the game before on this podcast, haven't I?
You have, actually.
And it was called Currently Running Processes.
It was, yeah. You were very kind about it, actually.
And it's a game where you are side-on game where you jump between buildings and go down elevators to get inside and then get near security devices, and when you're close enough to them you can see what their name is and you have to type in their name to hack them and disable them.
Exactly, yeah. So you're this kind of renegade hacker running around a city, climbing skyscrapers and stealing dark secrets from inside of them, and that's done by typing the names of things in slow motion and bursting out of windows and throwing other people out of windows.
What was your other suggested name?
Typing of the deck. Because you have like a hacking deck and you type in it. Might be slightly infringing. one of the security devices you can hack in the game is Windows, because naturally Windows are electronic devices that shatter on the spot.
I'm working on a lore reason for it. I had some suggestions, but I'm sure I'll think of one.
And so you can throw yourself towards a window and then have to type the window's name before you hit it so that it shatters on contact and you go into the building rather than bouncing off it and falling to your death.
Exactly. And there's lots of overlapping things that you can do. So there might be a security camera that you could disable, or you could save it for later, and then you can send a fake alarm to it so the guards are sent in the wrong direction on your way out. Yeah. So there's a lot of... The idea is that you are quite weak and vulnerable, but you're using the building itself. That's your tool. That's your like weapon set to get in and out, either undetected or in a hail of gunfire, one or the other. But almost everything in that game is going to be procedurally generated in some way. So the skyscrapers have their layouts generated. The corporations that own the building, their slogans, their logos will be procedurally generated. They'll follow you throughout the city.
That's the thing I'm most excited about now, is the corporate logo generation.
Yeah, it's going to be good fun. One of my plans for the game, I don't know, and this sort of ties into using procedural generation in a slightly different way, is that I'd like people to generate a set of corporations and then keep them for a few games and actually feel like there's something about them that they want to retain. Maybe they have a unique style in some way, or they defend their buildings in a particular
way. I like how they don't lock their doors.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. They leave all their valuables out overnight.
I've always admired that about you.
But I think... So that's, you know, I think procedural generation is seen as throwaway, for instance, whereas I'd really like to generate something and then feel attached to it, feel like I didn't want to reset it again.
Yeah, I've always thought there's a trick you could do where you procedurally generate content, but you limit it. So you make a game that just has 10 levels, and they are procedurally generated, but you don't tell anyone, and they're the same for everyone. And then you say, and in the first week, I've got an expansion of 5 levels for you, and it's free for everyone. And the next week, you say, I've got another expansion of 5 levels, just like totally free for all players. And you just treat it as if it's handcrafted content so that it feels rarer and people take it more seriously.
Right. But I mean, that is, like, that's a funny idea, but I think there's something in that as well. And I think with Heat Signature, I don't know how much you want to talk about it on the podcast. I know you mentioned it from time to time.
But as much as possible. Okay. The whole podcast will be just about Heat Signature, if it's up to me.
Well, like, I think that's what you've got to a certain extent. Like, you're generating this galaxy with all these stations, and I think people will become attached to it, and they'll play it for many sessions. Like, it's not just to be thrown away, even though you can throw it away. You want people to feel like...
There's a destroy galaxy button. I actually had to think about that because I just did the selection process for galaxies, and so I have to decide how many can you have. Because if I just give you one, then in order to try a new one, you've got to destroy the old one, which is a bit much. Like, all your characters you've ever made will all be dead. Everything you've ever achieved will be undone. But if I give you infinite slots, then they feel kind of throwaway, and you would just keep generating. And, well, you might not, but you could just, keep generating new ones and just move from galaxy to galaxy, just kind of like mess around. And I kind of want to communicate something about they're somewhat valuable.
Yeah.
A galaxy
yeah.
is somewhat valuable, I think. It's not unfair to say. But at the same time, you need a little bit of freedom so you can, after you've tried it one way, you can try it another way and explore that without erasing your previous one.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that.
Thanks.
But no, so I mean, so the day this podcast comes out, I'm going to be talking about this game and I'm going to be working on it more regularly and hopefully writing lots and lots about its procedural generation and maybe streaming bits when I'm developing parts of it as well, because I've come up, there's been some cool problems I had to solve and hopefully I can talk about them, even if they're not delicate cultural or sigils or poetry or anything like that. I still think they're pretty cool.
So. I don't think the creation of corporate art is an important part of culture.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could make a sort of almost satirical corporate logo generator where it's, you know, just these absurdly primitive shapes. Like every corporation seems to think they want to be like a triangle with a square in it, and that symbolizes all of their values.
There's just statues of that all over the building.
News then, eh?
Yeah. Since our last podcast in December, both of the big VR companies have announced something. The Oculus opened pre-orders. I think that's new since our last podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
And it's, what, $500? Is it $500?
I think it's £500.
Oh, yeah, I think it's $600 and £500, which is sort of especially brutal to us in the UK. Because $600 is not £500. And the Vive now has a camera on the front so that you can see the real world while you're in VR. And they announced that sort of by itself. And the funny thought that occurred to me is that it's just one camera and VR is 3D and it's stereoscopic, which predicts different images to both eyes. But because there's only one camera, it'll only be able to see the real world in 2D. The simulation will be 3D and the real world will be 2D.
Wow.
And,
so in a way, the real world will become less real to you
exactly.
than the digital
one. Doesn't make you think. But I've seen videos of it since and they've really embraced that idea. And the real world is not even, it's not displayed to you like a sort of live feed. It's displayed like an outlines. It sort of does edge detection on the real world. Uh-huh. You just see everyone like sort of spectral cartoon characters or something. They're really trying to stress that the real world is not that real. You can just,
you don't want to go back to it. Just don't worry about it.
But I'm very glad they're doing that. Not because I'm excited about like AR style real life integration, but because having used VR at various events, so for the Vive, you're standing up and your two controllers you're using are shown in the game world as well as the real world. And I talked before about how one of the first cool thing you notice about it is that you can just reach out in the real world and pick it up and know exactly where it is without being able to see the real world because it's so one-to-one. But if you're, for anything else that you play with like a normal controller or a mouse and keyboard or anything, the second that controller is not in your hand, you don't know where anything is. And when I've used the Oculus, I've sit down and I just have to ask the person demoing it, can you just please put the controller exactly in my hands? Because I'm just completely a helpless baby. I can't do anything for myself at all. And in order to do anything for myself, I'd have to unstrap myself, take my headphones off, take my VR thing off. And it's huge and heavy. You got to put it down somewhere. Then, and you know, to put it on needs both hands. So you got to drop whatever you've then located. So just being able to see reality without having to switch out of it is a really big deal. What do we think about Oculus price? Do we have any opinions?
It's high, but I kind of imagine that's to be expected, isn't it, really? I mean, the weird thing is, I was absolutely certain that the Vive's price had already been announced, and it was surprisingly low, so that might have just been a dream I had.
I think long ago they said, like, $350 was what they're aiming for.
Right.
And then there was a news story where Palmer Luckey said, oh, it's going to be north of $350 or something like that.
Right.
They warned that it would be more than that, but they hadn't really given an idea of how much more.
Oh, no, I meant the Vive, sorry.
Sorry.
I thought the Vive had been, when it was first announced, I thought they'd given it a price point which was in the... the £200 range, which is obviously mental now, looking back at it. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I assume because it has lighthouses with it. Lighthouses are expensive things.
Yeah. Well, it might be that they did give a ballpark price for the base unit, but weren't including all the other apparatus that might come with it.
Well, actually, the Oculus price does not include motion controllers. It just includes like a 360, like a Xbox One controller for some reason. And you don't get the... I forget what they're called, but the Oculus has its own in-hand 3D controller type thing. I think those are the real, a big part of the real revolution is that just the input is going to be so different for these games that we just watched a trailer for a game called Budget Cuts, which is a stealth game in VR where you sort of, you teleport around, you're basically using blink, but it's in the form of a gun where you fire it off. I guess it's a translocator from Unreal Tournament.
Yeah, what a great way of getting around the fact that you don't want to be walking around your flat and bumping into things.
I was already thinking, you know, because that's the, with the Vive, you have a space that you can walk around in freely, but you can't, if you want to get out of that, the equivalent of that in game space, you have to basically teleport. We'd already talked about how, like, the blink from Dishonored is the perfect mechanic for that, and sure enough, the first sort of interesting-looking stealth game we've seen for VR uses basically blink. But something I'd never considered until I saw it in that trailer is, like, picking up a ragdoll body and putting it in a, like, locker freezer type thing is so fucking cool if you're doing that with your real hand and just gripping it and, like, it's, you know... He kind of hurls it in and then slams the lid down on it, and it's, there's something so tactile and physical about it and kind of inherently funny.
Tactile corpse hiding. That's what you want.
Yeah, I just wanted better, more sophisticated ways to interact with corpses.
Do you feel like the teleportation mechanic means that you could be sat at a desk playing that? Are you kind of surprised that it's Vive?
Well, there's a lot of stuff about, like, reaching around. I guess within a certain location... I think you teleport freely around, and then within that location you could sort of walk around and sort of go through drawers and then reach over to a computer and stuff like that. I can imagine it would lose something if you were sitting down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, there did seem to be a small amount of movement on foot in that trailer we just watched. I don't know. I'm not really bothered about the room movement stuff, since I probably won't necessarily be living in a, you know, a room which will accommodate it. Like, I mean, this room probably isn't big enough to be marching around all over the place.
No.
Yeah, I wonder. Virtual cat. I wonder how many games will use the 3D controllers but not be walk aroundy games.
Well, I imagine most, if they are cross compatible with systems which don't have room movement.
Yeah, I guess the room movement things have to be Vive exclusive and only work for people who have that space available to them, which even after the price comes down will be only a subset.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about the Oculus price release I found was that I suddenly lots of developers on Twitter who'd previously, like small indies who'd previously been kind of interested, were maybe wavering a little bit and expressing some concern about getting into it because they were worried about the potential audience that it would have, at least initially. Which I guess is a concern.
I feel that way about any new technology anyway. Even before they announce the price, I always think, well, I'm not making a game for that because it'll have like 20 players. Same for like Ouya, and you know, so many developers like jumped on that immediately because it was a cool new thing. And even given its huge success on Kickstarter, I couldn't help thinking it's not going to be, if it ever does get big, it won't be big like right away. It's going to be a long time before that marketplace is big enough to sustain, you know, to live off. I forget what I was going to say. Oh, yeah. I think to offset the shock of the price, Oculus also gave a free retail kit to anyone who backed them on Kickstarter at the level where you get a dev kit. So, you know, back in the day when you backed it,
you paid enough
to get a dev kit to play around with. Now you also get the final hardware too, which is one of those things I hadn't really thought about you not getting that, but I guess that makes sense that you wouldn't. And I think that has... I think it's a good move because, you know, who bought the dev kits? Developers. And since they backed it, the Vive has been announced. And although, like, and I think in public perception, Oculus is still the sort of default main thing that most people know about. Amongst developers, because so many of them have tried the Vive, there's a much stronger pro-Vive contingent. And, you know, if I had to summarize, I would say generally the developer sentiment is that Vive is going to be the more interesting thing. But by just sort of giving all those people a free Oculus final kit, and now they're kind of by default in Oculus's camp and would have to consider spending a huge amount more money to, you know, get into Vive stuff. What have you guys been playing?
Mike?
Well, I've been playing something which I feel... I don't know whether this was an early access thing or whether I just saw lots of it on Twitter, but I've been meaning to play it for quite some time, which is a game called Master Spy. You see any? There were lots of very attractive gifts going around. Yeah, yeah.
This guy in an invisibility coat.
Yeah, a trench coat, no less. yes. So it's very 80s inspired. Like I said, trench coat, got a noir vibe, got a bit of cyber in there. Of no interest to anyone in this room or this podcast, obviously. those kind of themes. It really goes all in on the aesthetic. It's got these beautiful cutscenes that are rendered like they've come out of an 80s home console kind of setup, There's this ever so slight fisheye effect on the screen that just peels it away at the edges. But the game itself is a platformer. It's a platformer. And it's a fairly hard platformer. You're sort of dodging and weaving through these security systems as you break into buildings to, well, usually to steal something, but often you don't really pay attention to that. You're just trying to get to the end of the next screen. What you're trying to steal is sort of inconsequential. So guards will look in a direction, and if you're in that direction and you're not cloaked, they'll grab you. But when your cloak's on, you move slower. And if you touch them, they'll still be aware of you. And then, you know, it's the complications escalate. So dogs can sense you even when you're cloaked, and they just charge straight at you. And some motion detectors don't care whether you're cloaked or not. They just care if you're moving. And so each screen is this sort of complicated layering of all these different elements. And as you look at them, you think, well, okay, I can move but not be visible here, and I can be visible but not move in these sections for only half of the time. And you're sort of mentally planning out this beautiful route through the level, and then you instantly fuck it up, obviously, anyway. It's fun. It's got the kind of instant retry. There's not too much punishment to it. Although there is still this nagging feeling of, am I bad at this game or is this level just absolute bullshit? Like, which one is it? And, at some point I will rage quit out of the game normally after a session, but I have fun up until that point. It's pretty good. I think one of the things that's made it worse for me is that, this month was Awesome Games Done Quick. I don't know if either of you got a chance to watch much of that.
Yeah.
That is always a good week of viewing, where people kind of play games. They speedrun games, 24-hour stream from somewhere in Virginia, I think. And it really is an incredible week. But this just gets me in the mindset of, I could be a speedrunner. And so you're playing Master Spy, and you're like, yeah. And you're going to rush to this level, and you've got your safety strats, which is what you call anything when you sit and think for longer than 4 seconds. That's me using a safety strat. And in reality, I'm just garbage. But it's really good fun. It's very simple, but I just really enjoy the aesthetic, really. That really does sell it, even though the controls are very nice. The jumpy has a good jumpiness feeling to it. And it's got this strange thing where it doesn't tell you how anything works, which, at least as far as I can tell, which is not uncommon for games these days. I think there's a little deep end, figure it out as you go along kind of thing. But that's, in the end, I ended up kind of digging it because it gives you this sort of unease when you enter a new level and you kind of just work out what something does by looking at it or by exploding in front of it. but then at the end of the world, it will rate you on how well you did. And then I feel like, well, I don't want to have to go back and do that again just because I didn't know what was going on when I came in. And that kind of thing's a bit frustrating, but I'm never going to get a high rating anyway, so I normally just go to the next world.
What does it rate you on? Just time?
So number of times you got seen, which is basically number of times you died, time as well. I think those were the only two criteria. I got Fs on everything. It's like just garbage. Just absolute toilet.
There isn't sort of like soft failure where someone sees you but you still survive.
No. So detection in any form instantly freezes the game and it's game over. Which,
my God,
is strange because it sells itself as a stealth game, but it's really not. It's really kind of like a Super Meat Boy-esque platformer in some ways. It's just the spikes are these invisible sight lines that people have, which is sometimes it's a little bit confusing. So they have cameras that just sort of flip left and right, which is a little bit hard to detect out of the corner of your eye sometimes. But because everything has infinite vision, like there are no vision cones because it's just a straight line. It does make it a lot easier to parse, and they can't look up, so it's really just like vertical and lateral lines. Yeah, it's
God, famous. Look up.
Exactly.
And presumably the dogs.
The dogs just
can they
completely
smell
unable
up?
To. They know. No.
Dogs can't smell up.
They can smell backwards. they can smell backwards, but not up.
Excellent.
So it's just your mind can kind of abstract away the aesthetic, which is a shame, and just see it as like lines that you can't cross and can cross. But I think that loses it for me, so I still like to pretend I'm running around wearing a trench coat and going invisible. yeah. I like it.
Yeah. AGDQ was cool. I saw a couple of fun things. I saw the Talos Principle run that you recommended. And then I also watched Snapshot, which is...
Oh, yeah, I didn't watch that one. I didn't.
A game that... I don't know when it came out, because Graham and I both remember seeing it before release, and I even played it before release, I think, in the IGF, and then I don't recall it ever coming out, but apparently it's been out for some time. A side-on platformer where you take a photo There's like a frame around your cursor, and when you click, it takes a photo of that, and then you can kind of move that photo somewhere else. So if you take a photo of a box, then you can move the box, and you can also rotate the photo, and if the box is falling, then you can rotate the photo and it'll shoot out the side. And the thing I wanted to say about the AGG Q-Run is that because you can propel objects in that way, and you can also kind of, it's like a lot like portals, because you can do things like let the box fall and then catch it again and then move it up and drop it again so that it keeps gaining speed. And that's obviously a good speedrunning trick. So you keep doing that, then you hit yourself with it and bounce yourself across the level. And so all that matters really is, where's the object? Is there any objects at all? And so the guy does it with keys. He does it with collectible objects that are supposed to be things you only do for 100%. And then on one level, you can clone yourself by taking photos of yourself. And so he clones himself over some spikes, kills the clone, takes his skull, and then hits himself with his own skull to prevent himself across the level, which is emergent.
Yeah, I enjoyed the Splunky one as well, because they had Derek Yu on call, and he obviously wasn't aware of a lot of the ways in which his own game could be exploited. Yeah,
it was an all shortcuts run, so they had to unlock every shortcut in the run.
That was confusing.
Yeah. By bringing certain items to the shopkeeper. I think I learned pretty early on with Splunky that the shortcuts weren't a good way to play if you want to get better, because you want to be replaying the early levels as well. Mm. And if you can do that, then you start the next world more powerful than you would do if you just went there with a shortcut. And so in the latest PC version, I don't think I've ever actually tried it. And I didn't realize you had to bring like sort of three different things to the shortcut guy just to unlock that one shortcut. And the next time you go bring three different things to the next shortcut guy. And it's fucking grueling.
Yeah. I think it was, I guess they needed to give some kind of structure to the run, which makes sense. But I actually kind of like those speed runs where the game's very unpredictable, like a Binding of Isaac run with no set seed, where you have absolutely no idea what's going to happen and they just have to improvise. I think that's a really exciting kind of speed run.
There was also linked in relation to that was Derek Yu on the speed run wondered aloud. People were talking about like, oh, they do pacifist runs. And there's also no gold runs. We're not allowed to pick up any gold, gold becomes like a deadly hazard. And so Derek, you wondered, has anyone done a pacifist no gold run? And somebody has.
Oh my God.
It's fucking amazing to watch. We should put it in the show notes, because the way they deal with Yama, because they do a hell run. Like, they go all the way to hell and complete the game. And to complete, you can get past Olmec, the normal boss, without killing him. Or get to hell, at least from there. And, but then the final boss is like, you have to kill him before the door opens. So how do you kill someone non-violently? And the solution to that is surreal. And I think unintended by Derek, but he seems pleased with it.
I don't think I've seen that run. Or...
I don't know. Maybe we should leave that out as a spoiler.
Yeah. We can just link the timestamp in the show notes, and then you can go straight to it.
I did like the... I think it's... You might have to correct me here, but I think... Is it that you whip a stack of three gold bricks and it doubles in value or something strange like that?
And that you can also run across a two-square gap if you whip backwards or something?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, backward whipping.
Oh, my God.
All kinds of little quirks of physics that the experts have discovered.
Yeah. You think you've run a game enough to know even little things like that, and you just haven't even started.
Yeah. Whipping arrows out of the air is just second nature to them. They just do that reliably. Yeah. You don't even need to wait or like bait an arrow trap out. You just always let the arrow trap shoot you and just whip the arrow out that way.
Yeah, that was the first time I'd seen that done. I didn't know that was possible. That blew my mind.
I've actually done it accidentally once. A bat came to me at the moment an arrow shot me, and I was trying to whip the bat, and I got the arrow.
What have you been playing, Tom?
I've been playing two things, one new and one old, and the new one is Kingdom. Not a terribly descriptive title. A very unusual type of game, because it's a side-on city builder, which I don't think I've ever seen one of those before. And so it looks almost like a platform like Rogue Legacy or something, and has very pixelated art, and is really beautiful. It's got wonderful parallaxing on the backgrounds as you walk along. You are either a princess or a prince on a horse. Actually, a queen or a king, I think. The whole ground is just completely flat, and all you can do is move left or right or drop a coin. Those are the only three commands in the whole game. And using that, you must build a town and then a city and defenses and collect taxes from your peasants and fight off hordes of monsters that come in from portals. And basically you walk around and I think the first thing you come to is like a campfire. And certain things in the world have little sort of coin slots above them. And if you're near one of those and you hold down the coin button, you put the coins into the slots and they are created. Or actually, I think maybe the first thing sort of creates a town automatically. You I don't know, conquer the fire? I don't know. Use the fire to found a town in some sense. But then after that, when you put coins in, like, there'll be a sort of pile of mud. And if you walk up to the pile of mud and put coins in its slot, that means you're ordering your people to build a wall there. It's all totally nonverbal, and it's all done through this coin interface. So it's all weird, you know, just you have to read the land to figure out what it's letting you do, and often you don't know. You just, there's a pile of mud and there's coin slots in it. You know you can put coins in slots, so you do it, and then eventually someone with a hammer comes along and builds a wall for you. And then you find out that, like, a pile of rocks will build a tower, and a little weir type waterfall type thing. If you put coins in that, someone will come and build a mill, and then you learn if you buy a scythe, then your villagers can pick up the scythe and go and harvest corn and make money for you that way, because of course the only resource is gold. So harvesting wheat just makes money. Shooting rabbits makes money. Chopping down trees makes money. Oh, to chop down trees, by the way, you have to put one coin in the tree, and then the someone with a hammer comes along and cuts down the tree with their hammer somehow, and that causes the coin to come back out, so you get a refund for your tree coin. So it's like, in some ways, completely gamey and artificial because it's putting coins in slots, but then in presentation it's so natural and sort of organic and beautiful looking. It's pixel art, but it's also got sort of real-time dynamic lighting and beautiful effects on the pixels, and the, like, which things you can and can't build. There's a kind of limit to civilization, you know. Initially it's just that campfire, and then you're allowed to build one thing either side of it, and then as you build more, the next day you'll be allowed to build a bit further out than that. You sort of, your civilization has to be established for a day, and then its borders kind of expand, but there's no border marker or dotted line or anything. You just have to sort of look. And I found that if there's kind of knotted brambles around stuff, that means it's part of the wilderness, and if the deer are kind of lurking around that area, that means that's wilderness too, and you haven't extended your civilization there yet. And you can sometimes just sort of, like, cut down a bunch of trees and that will expand your empire. And other times building stuff is the way to do it. But that stuff is, you know, very organic and natural, and not clearly gamified. But then everything else is putting coins and stuff. And, like, to get new people for your village, you just, like, keep riding left or right. It's huge actual land. You can go really far in either direction, but past a certain point, you're just going deeper and deeper into the forest, and it gets darker and darker, and you're getting further from your village, and if your village is attacked while you're away, that might be bad. And to get new people, you just keep riding till you find a camp, and then you just throw a coin at the peasants, and then they pick up the coin, they instantly become loyal to you and walk all the way back to your village. And then if you want them to become an archer, you just have to buy a bow from the bow seller, and he just puts it, like, at the front of a shop, and then eventually someone will wander by and pick it up, and then you've got a new archer. So it's all, like, totally hands off. You can't tell anyone to go anywhere. You can't give anyone direct orders. All you can do is just throw coins.
They're very suggestible.
Just... yeah. It's amazing because it's, like, it's quite a cute and nice game in some ways, but then also you are just a sort of monarch on a horse who just throws money at people to solve every problem. Like, you literally throw money at all your problems. You there, have a coin. You fix this. You build that. Come on. And you're trying to defend them against, every night the portals on either side of your village open and a little sort of horde of trolls with masks run out and attack your village, and if you've got some archers, they'll fight back. And it's got, like, a wonderful atmosphere to it. There's really I think very sophisticated sort of weather and day night cycle, and it's to the point where I'm sort of excited to see the sunrise, because it will be a unique scene. Like, it might be foggy and drizzling with a red glow of the sunrise, or it might be a bright, sunny, beautiful morning, or it's got way more kind of depth and variety to that than you expect from a kind of retro style game, which it otherwise looks like. And initially it's very satisfying and very cool just to, you know, have this very hands-off method of just throwing money at stuff and sort of just deciding, yeah, I'd like a mill there. I think I'll have a tower there. And you chop that down that tree and all that stuff. And sort of sitting back and watching it happen, like in, you know, Prison Architect. Or, funnily enough, the game it reminds me of most is Rimmed Capsule, which is a top-down space station building game where You expand in Tetris-shaped pieces, and again, you have to sort of, you just tell people where you want things, and eventually they'll get around to doing it. And if you want people to defend, you have to just place some guns, and they'll pick up the guns, hopefully. And like Rimmed Capsule, it's exactly the same frustration, which is sometimes you really need specific people to do specific things, and it's life or death. The whole civilization will fall if this guy doesn't fucking move over there and shoot the guy! Come on! And so I played it twice. The first time through, I just didn't understand the rules about how death works, and so I was just running out to the sort of trolls who are running around. It's so singular in this one resource idea that you don't have any health either. So when someone hits you, they just take some money from you. And in fact, if someone's coming towards you and they're coming towards like one of your guys, and you like, you know, say there's a farmer out front because he won't fucking move behind the archers because he's a fucking idiot. What, and there's a troll coming towards him, one way you can deal with that is run up to the troll and just throw some money at him. And if the troll picks up anything, he'll run back to his portal with it. So if he kills a villager, he'll take their tool and run back. And oh, also, no one can ever die. If someone is defeated by a troll, they drop whatever they're carrying, like a bow or a hammer or whatever, which defines their role, and the troll steals that and takes it back, and then they get back up and they sort of go back to being neutral, so you have to pay them again if you want them to work for you. Like, I don't want to work for you. I died last time I worked for you. So yeah, you can throw money at trolls to get rid of them. And that's also your hit points. Like, you just have a sack of money, and when they attack you, they take a coin from you. And once you run out of coins, they take your crown. And if they take your crown, something really kind of subtle but strange happens, which is they take the crown and the camera follows the crown. And so your person on the horse is just left there and you can't control them anymore. And I think maybe you can control them. The camera isn't focusing on them anymore. It just stays on the crown as they take it back to the portal. And once it's gone, it just says, with no crown, there is no queen. And the game ends. So you're playing as the crown all along. Which explains why the only currency is money and you just throw money at. But yeah, so that was the first time I died. Then the second time I died, I'd sort of figured out that, oh, you don't want to just build everything you can build. You maybe want to, you know, skip. One of the problems I was having in my last empire is I built a tower right outside my base. And a tower is a thing that archers can man. And so an archer would go to the tower and sit in there. And as I expanded in that direction, I no longer need an archer there. I need an archer at the frontier where the actual trolls are attacking, because I've got farms there, I've got vulnerable things. And there would always be an archer in the first tower. And I thought, if I could just destroy that tower, that archer would have to go to the front and actually help defend the stuff I want to defend. But there's no way to tell anyone to move anywhere, and they'll just always, you know, just waste their life in a tower that you wish you'd never built. So next time through, I tried to bear that in mind and thought, okay, this is the strategy of the game. You don't build those early towers. You try and build them as far out as possible so that the people kind of have to fill the right slots to some extent. And I actually left one side of my base just unexpanded, just defended it and didn't build out in that direction at all, and just built out all in one direction and was as scant as possible on defenses, and only built them when I really needed them, and tried to hire more people. And then that worked for a time, sort of like 20 minutes, and then the waves of enemies just got so ridiculous that there was no way I could ever defend against them, and I lost again. And I'll probably never play again. Well, it was a beautiful, short experience, but I don't get the sense that I could ever do any better than that. No. It was just, you know,
is there an end point?
No, I think it's just, in fact, it tells you right at the start, every kingdom falls. And it's just a question of how long you can last. But
you've had that story now.
Yeah. It was cool while it lasted, but I didn't get the sense that there was anything else I could do to... I mean, sure, there is advanced tactics, and you can do better than that, and that I know there's new waves of monsters and different weapons that your guys get, and someone built a catapult towards the end of my last game. But I didn't, when I died, I didn't think, oh, next time I'll do this to prevent that. I was just like, oh, okay, well, this just happens sometimes because you can't control people. I'm kind of torn as to whether they should let you control people, because I understand their desire to keep it minimalistic, and it is kind of beautiful the way you just have three buttons and you manage a whole empire that way, but it needs like four buttons. Just one more, just to say, like, destroy this building. Like, that would do it, because then you wouldn't be wasting archers there, and you could kind of indirectly place your people by sort of saying, well, you can't go there because I'm getting rid of that.
Did it ever get to the point where there was a fatigue between moving? Like, it felt, in my mind, it would take a very long time to move from the left-hand side of the kingdom. And you're like, oh,
yeah.
God, you know.
It's almost fine, except that it's almost fine because you can gallop, so you can go fast. But there's a sprint meter, a hidden sprint meter, where your horse will start panting. And then if you try and gallop then, he'll rear up and get annoyed.
Ask for a coin.
And it's, yeah, because it's a one-dimensional game, essentially. It's not even 2D. You can only go left or right. it's not a good place to have a sprint meter. I don't think you ever really want to be telling a player, no, going too fast would be, too powerful, because everything is just left and right movement. So sometimes, yeah, you do want to go a long way.
What was the other game?
Nuclear Throne.
Yeah.
I complained about it before because I think I probably said some positive things, hopefully, but I was mainly pissed off about the portal thing that sucks you in at the end of each level.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm still like pissed off about that.
Why are you pissed off? Because you don't like to be slurped into it before you've had a chance to hoover up everything.
Yeah, it's so random because you don't know what the last enemy is. Sometimes, there's no way you could know because you can't see what's off the next screen. Mm. It's an empty dead end or whatever.
Doesn't that create an interesting tension?
Nope.
Okay.
And it's just so maddening to see, a box with a new weapon in it and you can't get there because you've been sucked in already, or see a whole, canister of rads and just all these treasures. And the worst thing is you kill a boss and it drops some unique weapon you've never seen before, and the portal just sucks you in and you can't get it. And it's just, oh, well, fuck it then. Most of my runs of Nuclear Throne ended me saying, oh, fuck it then. And at first I thought that meant I didn't like the game, because I would always play it and 5 minutes later be saying, oh, fuck it then, and quitting. And then I realized I've been sort of working a lot more this year and having short breaks where I do something totally different that's kind of not mindless, but just not sort of super taxing on the brain, is really useful. And so a game that I can play in 5 minutes is actually really appealing because it fits into lots of break times. And so I played it a lot and I've got a bit better at it, and I've also discovered more weapons and discovered more about which mutations are cool to take and what kind of loadouts work well. And it basically ends up being like rolling a dice, and if you get 5 or 6, you're going to have a great time. And if you get anything else, you're going to have a sort of pretty good time and then die to something really frustrating. And the 5 or 6 is if you open a weapon crate early on, you get a melee weapon. It's going to be awesome because melee weapons are brilliant in it. They make no sense. You can attack people through walls with them. They can deflect bullets. And basically melee is just a totally different game. A really good one. And the guns are good too, but you have to get good guns. Otherwise the gun game is just sort of, awkward. And the sort of thing that really determines whether you're going to do well or not is just the levels you get. And some levels are literally just a big square empty room. Well, not empty, sorry. A big square room with no cover at all, no possibility of hiding from anything. And every single enemy in the room is all in there in direct view. And a massive boss is there who immediately wakes up and fires bullet hell arcs of things.
Wow, does that happen often? I've never seen that, I don't think.
Yeah, well, I don't know how often in numerical terms, but enough to annoy me. And half the time I die, cause of death is big open level. Start of the level, it was a big open level, so I died. And often I can't see anything I could have done differently except just, I guess, picked a different character. So I had some different defense mechanisms, or if I'd found a melee weapon, I could have batted some of those things back. But if I didn't find a melee weapon, I just can't. There's just no way you can ever do it. Particularly if a fucking portal sucks you in before you can get to the crates to even find out if you get a melee weapon.
Boo-hoo.
But the more I play, the more satisfying combinations I find of weapons, and some of them are just fucking insane. There's a Gatling slugger. A slugger is a sort of shotgun that fires just one giant bullet instead of a spread. So the bullet is so large that it's essentially like a shotgun, except you slightly better and longer range. And the Gatling slugger is just that, but with infinite fire rate. And there's guns that I think I found one called a hyper rifle, which is, I've already had a machine gun, an SMG, an assault rifle, a minigun, a triple machine gun, and about 5 other guns that just fire bullets very rapidly. But a hyper rifle is on a completely different level. It'll just empty your entire ammo reserve in about 1 second. It's just this pure stream of bullets. And you keep finding weird ones. I found something called a seeker pistol, which fires 2 homing darts when you shoot it. A splinter pistol is a sort of mini crossbow shotgun type thing. Plasma rifles are a sort of ball of energy that goes through things. I had a series of deaths to finding a grenade shotgun. Finding a grenade shotgun, you got to try it. And I was careful. Like, I thought, okay, it's a grenade shotgun. It's going to explode when it hits a wall, so I won't fire it near a wall. I fired it, and just the world exploded. Just everything was just completely annihilated. And then the next, well, not the next run, but later in a run, I found it again, and I was like, grenade shotgun, no, learn my lesson, not touching that. And then next level, I found another grenade shotgun. I'm like, what the fuck? I mean, I've only found three in my life, and two of them are in this run. And then two levels later, I didn't pick it up again. And two levels later, I found an auto grenade shotgun. All right, well, I've got to try that. And it annihilated me. But yeah, that's the pleasure of it. It's just like, once, I think it's actually, the appeal of it is just gambling. It's that, that sense of, I don't rationally know, like, if I look at all my experiences with it, probably more than half of my runs have been in some way unsatisfying or annoying and have not given me what I hope to get from it. But because that, you know, five or six on the dice gets me a run that's so much fun. When I think about the game, I just think about that. I just think about, ah, but remember that time I had the auto slugger and the auto shotgun, sorry, the auto crossbow and the assault slugger, or that time I had the energy sword and the other thing, and it was so cool. Maybe I'll get that again. Maybe this time it'll be different.
What do you think makes failure in a game like that different to failure in Spelunky? Why do you think that doesn't feel like rolling a dice so much?
Well, in Spelunky, when I die, it's usually feels more as a result of something I sort of tried or something I did. Like, I can make it over those spikes, or I can do this. Yeah. I don't need to use a rope here. I don't have to use a bomb here. I can get past it this way. And if I do die to something that's kind of like, I'm just not good enough to do that, it's like a frog or a spider. And a common thing that you think when you die in Spelunky is fucking spiders or fucking frogs or fucking that. And I never say that. And well, I only say that about assassins in Nuclear Throne or Little Hunter, which is a boss. But 90% of the time when I die, I just say open level. It was just a big open level, so yeah. I was fucked. So it feels much more about just, there's so much more potential for a level to fuck you over just by its layout, and just the layout fucks you. And I don't think that's accidental. I think they probably know that some levels are harder than others. They're so random too. They're just like, some weapons just don't have a new weapon on them. Sorry, some levels don't have a new weapon on them. And some levels don't have a canister that gives you the XP that levels you up. Some levels just have like six enemies and that's it. And some levels, I've had a couple recently where it's just gone on and on and on. Just a massive chamber of things, and I mow down like 35 enemies, then there's another chamber, another 35 enemies, and then there's a third chamber of 35 enemies. And the next enemy, the next level will just be like a tiny chamber. So I think they know that the levels vary both in what the potential rewards are for them, how difficult they are, and all those things feel like they're just being combined randomly so that you can just get utterly fucked. You can have a level that's brutally difficult because it's open, but also just there aren't that many level that many enemies in total, so there isn't that much XP you'll get from it even if you get through it, and so you lose a load of health, spend all your ammo, and have almost nothing to show for it, and then next level you're in a worse situation than you would have been otherwise. I guess that's just sort of the game they're making. And it apparently does not stop me from being completely addicted to it. How about you, Mush?
I've been playing three games, although only really one in any significant quantity, which is obviously Rainbow Six Siege, the ultimate game, the game of, which is now retrospectively 2015's best game.
Really?
And probably 2016's best game.
What? You were, I mean, last time we talked about it, you were pretty scathing about the micro...
Yeah,
shit.
I still think that does distort the way that they've designed that game in a really poor way. I think they've made a huge number of errors with the way that they've structured that game. For instance, I mean, I mentioned this in our chat, private chat, but I think most people don't realize that if you finish all the tutorial missions in that game, it unlocks a new co-op campaign. Which is, seems to have completely bespoke levels which aren't anywhere else in the game. And I joined a lobby to, because it's online, it's not online co-op, and it took ages to, it didn't find anybody, presumably because nobody knows that it's fucking there.
Yep,
and it's because those tutorial missions are really quite hard to complete and actually not that rewarding because the AI cheats and you're only allowed one particular operative to use, and sometimes some of the operatives aren't all that good. So that's just a crazy error from the production perspective of how to release or advertise a game or what's even in your game. And there's loads of problems with that. You know, like the lobby system's a bit fucking rubbish, and it only tells you what game type you're playing for like 2 seconds, and then when you're choosing characters, you can't remember what it said, and so you know there's some characters there who have. Who can fire a cluster bomb into a room, which isn't ideal if there's a hostage in there that you want to protect. Things like that the way the game has been designed at a kind of more basic level than that is superb. And yet, obviously, they've layered on all this other stuff around it and framed it in a structure which doesn't best demonstrate its charms. But charms it certainly does have. And it is a mighty, mighty, mighty game, and I fucking love it now. And what's so crazy, I've played 50 hours of it, which I'm sure is, you know, piffling in comparison to the amount of hours that younger, more virile people can put into such games these days. But I would expect to have a familiarity with it after 50 hours.
Yeah.
And yet still, I find myself lost in those levels. And part of that is due to my incompetence. But I also have quite a good spatial memory. And it just surprises me that very regularly I'm just turned around the wrong way, or I don't remember how one particular area of a level I'm familiar with connects with another area. It just demonstrates to you the kind of space and the amount of possibility that they have built into that game, and just how kind of unwieldy and huge that is, and how much there is to mine from it. I'm still discovering completely new strategies that never occurred to me previously. Like there's and ways of mixing up the different capabilities of the operators. There's one guy who can attach kind of electric cables to stuff to electrify them, which is, so you put that on a barricaded wall, and it makes it difficult for people to place thermal charges on the other side because they get electrocuted as they're doing it. But you can also combine this with a skill of another operator who gets to put down these portable barricades, these kind of shield wall things that they slam into the ground and then pull up to about, you know, 4 feet in height or something. You can crouch behind them. Usually, you'd think that was a defensive thing, but you can actually use this to block doorways with it, pull it up to full height, and then get this other guy to electrify it. So if anybody tries to vault over it, they won't necessarily see that this little box of electric cables is behind it. They'll vault over it and electrocute themselves. there's lots of stuff like that. I'm still learning new ways of using the operators in different ways. It's a game with a huge amount of depth, and it's extremely beautifully thought out, I think, at that level of game by game gameplay, you know. The other games I've been playing, I played a new MOBA called Warhammer 40,000 Dark Nexus Arena, which is obviously Games Workshop's attempt at a MOBA. It's not very good yet, because it is not at all complete, which isn't necessarily surprising for an early access game. It's a free-to-play game. It's going to survive on microtransactions for cosmetic items, apparently. But what's bizarre about the way that they've released it is that they've released it in a state you wouldn't expect. I mean, you'd forgive a lot of flaws in early access, like you'd forgive bugs, you'd forgive, you know, imbalances, and you'd forgive collision detection issues and, you know, broken lobby systems and all these things that it does have. But it also only has one game mode at the moment, which is a game mode where it's basically a team deathmatch, and whenever you kill opponents, you get souls from them, and then you can bank those souls, and the team which gets to 20 souls first wins. But if you kill somebody who has souls on their person before they bank them, you get those souls. Yeah. Although sometimes that doesn't work. But the problem is with that, and the level that is available for you to play that in, is that it doesn't allow for any of the synergy between the character classes that you are familiar with in MOBAs. Like, MOBAs are built around, I mean, not exclusively, but generally they have a lane pushing element to them. You're going down these lanes which are otherwise locked in some kind of equilibrium with AI minions that are fighting against each other. You knock down towers, you break through these defenses, and it's a lot about kind of conquest of the environment. It's about, you know, working to a strategy about where you place pressure on these defenses, and, you know, where you back off and then move. But there's none of that in this. It's just team fights the game, and the problem is that just doesn't work with a lot of the characters they have. Like the support classes, there's no point. The matchmaking system, which I assume would normally match you with full teams, doesn't seem to work yet. So you can only go and play these drop-in, drop-out games, which means that you can't ever risk picking a support character, because you might be the only person on one team fighting against three other, assault class characters. And just, like, I mean, they seem to have thought about interesting skills for the characters to have, and it's more action oriented in interesting ways. It has more kind of skill shot element, but the game that they've chosen to release, at least in the form that they've chosen to release, just doesn't show off any of that stuff to any good effect. A lot of games get released in early access too early, but I fear for a game, particularly actually one which is free to play in this genre, because you can't, like, I mean, it's one thing to release an unfinished game and expect people to pay for it, but there's a level of investment required in a game which is going to survive on cosmetic transactions, because you need to have full ownership over those characters. You need to have been invested in some way in that game. I don't think anybody can do that yet, because it's just not in a state where you could even predict what kind of game it's going to be. So, an error, I would say, on the part of the developers. And the third game, which I can recommend, is a game called Pony Island, which is a very, very strange game indeed, in which you play what appears to be an arcade cabinet of this terrible side-scrolling platformer, which has been possessed by the devil. And this manifests itself in interesting ways. It's, well, perhaps not possessed by the devil. It's very unclear to me at this point in time whether it's a virus, or whether it is a virus that is possessed by the devil or something like this. It certainly uses the metaphor of Satan, Baphomet, and all these other demonic names. But how you progress through it is to hack the game. But blessedly, it doesn't involve any of that boring coding shit that you guys love so much. It's all done through these kind of cheeky, bizarre metaphors. So on one screen, for example, you go into the options menu and you just smash all the options up, and all the options fall to the bottom of the screen in these fragments, and you can reassemble them to say something else, which you then click and you get to another level of the menu. And there's other things. That's a kind of recurring thing is you click on these little glitches on the screen and you go into this other, I don't know exactly what it would be. It looks like several columns of code, but the code actually, as it is written, is irrelevant. What happens is this key kind of drops down line by line through one column of code, and you can place kind of arrows to direct it to shift it to another column of code, and it'll keep on dropping down, and maybe you'll put things in there which will reset it and move it back to the top again, and then move left and right, and it plays with this continuously. So at certain points you duel with demons who are at the same time as you moving these functions around. So as you place one to say move right, it'll take a function that you've previously placed and shift it somewhere else. But they do it with a pattern, so you can kind of begin to understand the pattern by which they try and sabotage you. And then
I was going to say, I have a question about this, because I was playing this game and I got to one of those sections in which it was kind of turn-based, and I placed one thing and then the enemy places one thing. First one of those was super easy, and then the next one of those, certain slots that you can place these commands into are black, and that means when something goes in there, it's locked in forever. And so if the enemy puts one in there that screws your code, then the game's over, basically. Well, not the game's over, but you have to click the reset button and start the puzzle again. And I, for the life of me, could not see the pattern in how he responded, because any of these slots, like on his first move, he could permanently screw you. He could put one, you know, any of these slots that are permanent are in a critical position. So he can, if he puts the wrong thing in any of those, he can permanently screw you. But he doesn't do that. And then, so he makes his move and it's a non-fatal one. And then I make my move. And sometimes his next move is he just puts one of those things in one of those slots and I'm fucked forever. And sometimes he doesn't. And I can't figure out why. And eventually I had to look up a walkthrough and just do exactly what they did in the walkthrough without understanding a single move that I did.
Well, maybe I lucked out, but I thought I'd understand it, which is not necessarily true. It's not actually true. But I thought you could fake him out essentially by placing things in the wrong columns first. Or placing things in unessential places, and then, because then he would shift stuff about, then you could reposition the things that he placed. But maybe I was just very lucky, lucky and stupid, which is how I like to play all of the games. but it's pretty funny. I think I don't know where it's going, but it's certainly interesting. It may be Frog Fractions 2. Who knows?
Yeah, it's got that vibe to it.
shall we do the questions from the questions?
Don't sound too enthusiastic about it. Yeah, I think we should.
Yeah!
Henry writes, dear Crate British Break Off. Is that because we've been on a break? I thoroughly enjoyed your mocking discussions last week over the operator names in Rainbow Six Siege, which I too have been rather enjoying. The names are so cheesy that whenever my friends play, if someone is left as a recruit, we spend the whole game talking to them in gruff voices, saying things like, first day on the job, huh? And if we make it out of here alive, you might just earn yourself a name, recruit. As you might expect, this thoroughly confuses, though hopefully entertains, the poor fellows put on our team. With the addition of an entertaining yet broken revolver to CSGO, we created... Oh, I think he's referring to they added a new gun to CSGO that was absurdly powerful. We created a new Steam group of sheriffs and renamed ourselves to Famous Cowboys and proceeded to message the other team with boy howdy. This bomb site ain't big enough for the both of us and other such schlock. Silly things like this are one of the reasons I adore online gaming. I guess the only question I can proffer is, do you ever act so monumentally silly online? I know Dota 2 is a good game for running Team Beard or other such silly combinations. I hope you enjoyed the story at least. Thanks for using them ear holes, partner.
You got a Dota story, Mike?
Yeah, he's absolutely right, of course, that Dota 2 is wonderful, partly because you're always interacting with some people that you don't know. I think the most recurring trick for me is that if something goes wrong in the game and you need to pause for some reason, unfortunately the enemy team can happily unpause, and they will every single time, so you need to develop new techniques for discouraging them from doing so. So my long-standing one is to break into a stand-up routine about Dota 2. Just normally just the worst kinds of crappy jokes I can think of, you know, just to keep them entertained, even if it's just to distract them, if nothing else.
So you're not the person who's pausing.
So our team needs to pause because someone else has disappeared, basically. Yeah. And just to do anything to keep them from unpausing.
You're the guy they bring on stage to fill the gap when the actor's like throwing a tantrum or something.
Keep the audience in check. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, how you doing tonight, folks? Good to have you all here today.
Can you give us an example of a good...
I don't know whether it'll make sense. So any time a patch has come out, how does everyone feel about the new Jakiro changes? I'm still in two minds about it, because Jakiro's a dragon with two heads.
I get it.
You see? Yeah, okay. There you go. And obviously, if there's any kind of ice-based hero.
Chat?
No, if only. That would just make, you know, I'd have the Seinfeld's SFX in the background.
Slap this. God, that'd be amazing, actually. That'd be a brilliant, like, video to do.
No, it's all in text, actually. You really have to push it with the emotes. But no, it's surprisingly effective in some cases. They really go and get into it. And sometimes, you know, they'll crack back at you. And given how toxic the game is, it's actually quite a nice moment of lightheartedness sometimes. You know? But, yeah. Yeah, what about you guys?
Well, nothing as performative and brilliant as that, I would say, but Rainbow Six Siege has inspired a lot of humour regarding the voicing in it, because there are, although it's not a kind of like, there's not a lot of dialogue in the game on the whole, there are barks that your characters do, and it's got a number of SAS characters who speak in Cockney accents by way of South Africa, I think. It's really hard to tell. But the guy called, there's a guy called Smoke, who you can probably imagine what his role on the team is.
Sledgehammer, right?
That's right! No, he has these smoke bombs that release toxic smoke. And he will occasionally refer to them as, my toxic bags are in position. But sometimes he'll refer to them as his beauties. And he'll say, my beauties are in place! He'll yell at this kind of weird tortured bark. My beauties are in place! It just sounds so good. So good. Now when I'm trying to rally the troops for a game, they say, my beauties are in place.
That's amazing. Tom writes, hi there, small crate and far away crowbars. I've been meaning to mail this question in for months, and the news that the Rift is about to go on pre-order has finally prompted me to get that done. I've not tried the Rift or the Vive, I almost called it the Valve, but I've had the money set aside to buy a VR headset once the Rift is announced. Seeing as you've tried them both, should I simply get the first headset that becomes commercially available, or is one of them clearly superior, and should I wait for that one? Thanks, guys. Tom. I wanted to read this one because I think I can pretty strongly say that the Vive is going to be worth waiting for. I think I'm only going to get that. I'm not going to bother with Oculus because there's nothing that Oculus can do that Vive can't, and there's something that Vive can do that Oculus can't, and it's quite a big thing. And
are you not worried this might be a VHS Betamax sort of thing?
I guess, yeah. It's going to, as we said earlier, it's going to have to be supported.
Younger listeners will have no idea what that means.
Betamax was a type of stone tablet onto which we carved early videos. I mean, it was before my time. I didn't know about Betamax, just to sort of make that clear. But it's Valve, so they're going to make something. They're going to make stuff. There's going to be, you know, they've already shown a Portal demo using this thing. I'm sure they're going to do something like that, whether it's Portal or not. And so it's going to be... That's something you'll be left out of if you have an Oculus. So it'll be interesting to see how many games support both, because they're quite different. And particularly, like, if the Oculus doesn't ship with those motion controllers, then that whole motion thing is now a special subset of VR. It's going to get quite complicated. But yeah, I mean, we don't know what the price is going to be. If it's like $1,200, then maybe not. But if it's comparable price, then the Vive, I think, is going to be a much better option. I mean, I should also say I haven't used the latest Oculus. The last time I used it was quite a long time ago. But it's one other thing is that motion sickness is more of a problem the less one-to-one the movement is. And that was the big thing that Valve were trying to solve with the lighthouses and tracking your movement with an external thing. Because if they can get that perfect, then motion sickness just goes away. That's basically all I know about that subject. Tony writes, hello, Crete and Nobar. Have you guys been able to catch any of the awesome games done quick, charity speedruns this year? Highlights have included the Spelunky stream with a designer and programmer talking to the runners, and Half-Life 2 without the crowbar were running at 150 miles per hour backwards. I actually didn't see that. The Half-Life 2 runner hadn't actually played Half-Life 2 without speedrunning it until recently.
Wow.
Said he was surprised by how dark and horrible the world is when you're not whizzing past it. I quite like the idea of playing games in an unintended manner and was wondering if any of you have done anything like that. I remember Tom Francis playing Galciv peacefully and also remember it being called Plan B. I once got on Kotaku for completing the Titanfall campaign / radio play.
What?
Without firing a shot, and I still get angry. I still get angry YouTube comments about me stopping to smell the flowers. my diary is called Plan B because I tried to play it peacefully. And that's not even really subverting the game, because that's one of the ways you can play the game. It's a 4X game, and they always allow you to work peacefully in that. I was trying to avoid war and just do cultural domination, but then I got far enough ahead that I could build the type of space station that can destroy suns. And so Plan B was destroy all the suns. Half-Life 2, I haven't seen this run, but I should. But they... It used to be that you could bunny hop in Half-Life 2, and it's a very old kind of exploit that's common to a lot of FPS games. But if you're, you know, sprinting and running, there's something about the moment that you hit the ground that allows your speed to just keep building. And so as long as you're bunny hopping, as long as you keep jumping as soon as you hit the ground, you never lose your speed, and it gets faster and faster and faster. And then Valve noticed this and thought, okay, we've got to fix that bug. And so every time you jump... they would subtract a bit of your forward velocity away, so you wouldn't get that, you know, bonus. But people noticed that actually it wasn't necessarily reducing your velocity, it was just a negative velocity in the direction you're looking. So if you turn around 180 degrees, not only does it not slow you down, now it accelerates. So last I heard, I haven't seen this latest run, so I don't know if this is still true in the latest version, but the fastest way to play Half-Life 2 is to just turn around and do it all backwards, which is amazing. Do you guys, I mean, I mentioned the Talos Principle run, but we didn't really talk about it.
It's really good, partly because it doesn't spoil anything about the actual puzzles, because he's just breaking those levels.
I actually avoided that run for that, because I was worried about that.
You do need to stop before the end, because there are story spoilers that are fairly inevitable. But it goes on for an hour, I think, or something like that, and it's kind of beautiful to watch him just bound around these levels and completely abuse all of the elements of actual puzzle design there.
It's a good one for how it's sort of done as well. Like, there's they vary in terms of like who is commentating on it, whether the runner talks or they don't, whether the developer is there or not. And in this case, the runner is just very good and very funny about, you know, very knowledgeable, but also good at explaining it to newcomers and explaining why things are difficult. And there's also someone commentating in addition to him, and he's also a speedrunner of the game, so he knows all the tricks inside out as well. And so he can tell you, like, that thing that he just did is extremely difficult because every surface of this wall is extremely slippery. They basically explain at the start, like, all these, you know, you get these laser redirectors and field jammers and other things, and they explain that, you know, the game is about placing these in elaborate configurations in order to disable things in the right order to get to certain things, but we're going to use them to climb on so that we can get on top of walls. And that is the solution to almost every puzzle in the game. You can just put that in a certain place, and again, it's a sort of like something that's designed to prevent exploits, that when you put something down, it pushes you back from it a little bit, so that you can't sort of, you know, default in an FPS is when you drop something, it goes in front of you, and the ability to put things ahead of you would be, you know, in some way lead you to break puzzles. So they push you back a little bit. And so if you put your back to a wall and drop something, then it squeezes you between the thing and the wall and shoots you upwards a little bit. And then if it's tree, turns out all of the trees are only solid up to the first 3 meters. So if you can get up to 3 meters, you can land on top of the tree whilst being inside the tree and then jump on top of one of the walls. And all the walls are, you know, it's open air basically. So no walls go to the ceiling. So every wall can be got on top of. And once you're on top of the walls, you can just sort of bunny hop along them and jump from one wall to the other. It's nuts.
I highly recommend the Shovel Knight's run as well. I think, both of those, like all the runs that they've done of that game, at AGDQ and SDGQ in the summer have been really good. One thing they noted this year is how many indie developers are slowly, like, taking into account the speedrunning community when they design their games. And Shovel Knight seems to be one of those games. I think Ori and the Blind Forest was another example.
Where, oh, really? Right, I haven't watched that one, actually.
The developer patched the game and they broke an exploit like a week before SGDQ last year. And so they pulled an all-nighter to revert the change just for SGDQ, which I think is amazing. That's incredible. Yeah.
Yeah, they talk a bit about that on the Talos run of like, they reminisce about something called the Mountain Goat Skip, which involved climbing across like a cliff. And it's been patched out, and someone even like writes in to say, "Oh, I can't believe they took that out. It's my favorite exploit in the game." And it's so weird because you don't know, like, is removing an exploit that the speedrunning community was enjoying, is that a positive or a negative? Because exploits in general, like if you knew about it before you shipped, you definitely would have taken it out. It'd be a no-brainer. If someone came to you and said, "Oh, we've just discovered you can totally bypass all the puzzles in the game by doing this," of course you'd take it out. And like, that seems an uncontroversial decision. But if it's already in there and then people use it for speedruns and then you take it out, it's weird to listen to speedrunners talk about this stuff because they're always sad when an exploit's gone. But if they, if all the exploits that people found in developing a game were left in, then it would be garbage to speedrun because it would be too easy. Like, I had a glitch in Gunpoint where you could jump through every wall in the game if you just stood in the right position. You could just glitch through everything. Yeah. I don't think speedrunners would enjoy that really because then the challenge is gone.
I'd like to see a video, not of a speedrun, but of speedrunners during their process for detecting exploits. Mm. Because I did try and break the Talos principle in certain ways when I was playing it. I got frustrated with the puzzle. I was like, I should be able to jump over this small wall because I can just about stay on this little block without slipping off. I can get up onto there, but there's an invisible wall there. Maybe if I pick this thing up and I can boost myself over. I tried a lot of times to break the puzzles, but I was thwarted. So I'd like to see somebody going around and just brutalizing those games until they find the way through those.
There's absolutely nutty stuff. There's jumps that you can only be done if you're running at 20 FPS. So you have to turn on the settings and reduce your frame rate.
Oh,
there's other jumps
right,
that can only be done at 200 FPS. So you have to run it at lowest possible settings on the best possible computer. And there are a couple that he couldn't do in the speedrun because his laptop just wasn't good enough. You need it, something can run it at crazy FPS because it's to do with certain like step, game physics happens in discrete steps, and so your frame rate determines when those steps will be, and I guess there's some kind of like sync error at certain frame rates that lets you do things. Other things are like there are a bunch of glitches in loads of games where you just have to bring up the pause menu at the right time, and I think there's one, I think it was Talos, where you have to bring up the pause menu then hold space and then come out of it and then like redo that, and it would let him get a crate through a barrier that you're not supposed to because I can't remember why. John Roberts, who listeners may remember from this podcast, writes, "Dear Scrubs, decades of violent media is slowly turning us all into blood-crazed sociopaths, so why not embrace us? Embrace it. Tell us the tale of your best kill. Cheers." Mine is from Hitman Blood Money, a game about killing, and a very open-ended one, and I loved how many different ways there were to take out a target. And there's one on a steamboat, I want to say. A boat on the Mississippi. And you have to kill the skipper. And of the ways to do it, there's you can dress up as a busboy, and he's like a big fat greedy man, and so you can bring him a cake, and you can inject poison into the cake. You have a sort of poison syringes that you bring on every mission, and any food stuff you can inject, and any drink that anyone's going to drink you can inject. Or you can also put a bomb in the cake, and once you're in his room, obviously you can just attack him directly in various ways, and so I brought him a poisoned cake with a bomb in it. I fed it to him, and then while he ate it, I slit his throat. Then I detonated the bomb, and then I shot him with his own revolver.
And he lived.
If it was Rasputin, he would have lived.
He's here tonight.
How about you guys?
Mike?
Well, I don't want to go back to Dota 2.
No,
but
please.
My...
Why not?
I don't think of myself as an arrogant person, or I try not to be, but my favorite hero in Dota 2 is Rubick, whose special power is that he can target someone and steal the last ability they used. And the thing is that is arrogance in hero form, because what you're saying is, I don't need anything extra, I just need what you had, and I'm going to do it better than you. And, you know, the ultimate situation in that, and it happens very rarely, is when a hero uses the strongest spell they have on you, thinking it'll kill you, and you survive with just a few, few points of health left, and you immediately steal it from them and just detonate them with it. And it requires every fiber of your being not to type "get fucked" into all the chat at that point, which is a common turn of phrase among the group that I play with. But yeah, there's no better feeling, I think. But Hitman just definitely comes a close second. There's just something about that game where anything you set up feels good. Pretty much anything in that game feels nice to do.
It just reminded me that I used to be a massive jerk in Duke Nukem 3D multiplayer, because we didn't play online in those days, and so I had friends around. We had two computers in my house, which was awesome. And I'd played it a lot, and my friends hadn't played it much at all, and so my friend who played against me, it was just one-on-one deathmatch. We only had two computers. All we could do is one versus one, and I was way better than him. And so every time I killed him, whatever weapon he was using against me, I would use that next turn to just show me that I could beat him with that. It wasn't just your weapon, you're just worse.
Oh, that is mean.
I never said that, but that was just like, if he was paying enough attention, he would notice.
I can't think of any examples that particularly display martial prowess, but if we are embracing our sociopathic sides, then I should mention how much I really fucking love killing horses in Red Dead Redemption. Honestly, there's almost nothing as sweet as riding on a horse at full pelt, then shooting it in the back of the head.
Oh my God. You shoot the horse you're riding?
Yeah.
Is that an objective?
No.
Like the handbrake, basically.
You do go over the handlebars, though. But the horse animation in that game is really good, but nothing is as good as the procedural crumpling of horses.
Man, I'm not a good human being, but I've never tried that. Amazing. Oh, we've all learned something about each other here. From the depths of Twitter, we have a question from What a Duck. At what point can we say an AI is creative rather than simply mixing together human-generated components and code? One for you, I think, Mike.
Are you sure? technically, anyway. Officially, my whole field of research that I work in is trying to answer that question.
It's called computational creativity, right?
It is. It is.
And so if it doesn't exist, you're in trouble.
It's getting a bit buzzwordy these days. IBM's quite interested in it. They want to get a slice of that sweet, sweet money pile that I'm obviously sitting on top of. it's an interesting question. I think over time, my understanding of that has developed quite a bit. So it used to be that I used to feel like that there was something out there and that software could eventually become creative and it was like a defined endpoint. Whereas nowadays, I think lots of researchers feel like creativity is this like ever moving target that we talk about a lot. And I definitely feel that the AI in general is just something that we as a society recognize as AI, basically. So, and I think this comes up with gamers a lot, where something is AI if we think it's intelligent or it's trying to be intelligent in some ways. And as soon as it becomes something everyday or something that we understand, I think it ceases to be interesting or AI-y enough. And it's because some things are AI even when there's nothing really intelligent about them, because we personally perceive them to be intelligent.
I read in all sorts of intentionality into nuclear throne spawning systems, like the weapons you find. I had sort of three games in a row where the first weapon I found was the last weapon I was using when I ended my last run. And I'm like, oh, so the game tries to give you back what you just had, so, cause in case you were enjoying it or something. And I thought, no, it's just fucking random.
And I think Desert Golfing is a similar situation where it doesn't actually matter at this point whether Desert Golfing's procedurally generated. It just matters what everyone thinks about it. And I find that super interesting because, I made a piece of software called Angelina. That was my PhD. And it generates games, and people have written things about Angelina that were never ever said or hinted at or implied or really there was any basis for at all. But they just felt like it was there, and they decided it was AI. And nowadays people are much less impressed by Angelina, and in the future it will continue. And I imagine in 15 years time, people will be like, why did anyone ever think this was interesting? And because over time our understanding just changes and our expectations for what is good AI shifts. And that's why I think it's so hard to go back to certain kinds of games. Like narrative-led games, we often find it very easy to go back to because we love that story and those characters and that world. And there are other games that you go back to and you think, I'm sure that I was blown away by how lifelike these characters were once upon a time. And now it just looks laughable. And I think that's a really tricky problem for when games try to sell themselves on the back of their AI. Not that there's many games that do that, but...
It's encouraging, though, that, you know, if we're making enough progress that the old stuff looks bad.
Definitely. That's how I see it. Yeah. I like that a lot. And it also means that you can make your life a bit easier sometimes by... I think lots of game developers realize this, but there are lots of things you can do that are very low effort but massively increase the perception of intelligence in AI. One of these things, quite famously, is barks, or, you know, when they say things, they say that they're reloading, or in fear, famously, soldiers, or perhaps infamously, soldiers would call for backup. Backup was never coming. but it didn't really matter, because if you killed them, you just thought that you got out of there before backup arrived. And if it just happened that another soldier wandered in from a nearby room, you think, holy shit, backup's here. So it was just win-win. There's lots of strange stuff like that, that just, that we're so, even when we actually invent AI, it's normally inspired by the history of AI. You know, we're constantly, these cutting edge AI companies are building themselves off science fiction ideas, and they're naming them things after, you know, old movies and old references to AI. And it's just this constantly churning, like, social construction of what artificial intelligence actually is. Really, it's just anything that a computer can do that we haven't perfected yet. Because once we perfect it, no one's impressed by it anymore.
In Crisis, the AI barks would be... they were Korean soldiers, I think I'm right saying. And on the maximum difficulty mode, their barks would be in Korean. And in all their difficulty modes, they would be in English.
I think that's great.
And so I always played in the maximum difficulty mode for other reasons to do with, like, damage scaling and stuff. But... I think I probably read more intelligence into them in Korean because I didn't know what they were saying.
Right.
So whatever they did, what they said might have been them saying, I'm going to do that.
Right. One of the plans I have for Rogue Process is to have an AI inside the game that attempts to predict what the player is going to do next based on the way they've got into or out of buildings in the past. So I'm going to use a bit of machine learning, hopefully. But I realized that it would be so much easier to fudge that by having guesswork, basically. Like, learning is actually less effective, because if you could accurately predict what the player was going to do, you wouldn't want to do it anyway. You'd want there to be some variance, because in the best case, it would just be unplayable. So you might as well have a system that is designed to fuck up half of the time, at least, because that's going to make the player feel cleverer in the end anyway.
A really interesting example is Infested Planet. Our friend Alex Wiltshire wrote a great piece for Rock Paper Shotgun recently about the history of AI beating humans. This is a completely separate piece I'm thinking of. He did write that piece, and that's interesting and relevant. But the piece I'm thinking of is a thing specific about Infested Planet, and it has a mechanical mutation where the enemy... Sort of the idea behind it was the enemy would adapt to your tactics. So if you use minigun guys a lot, then they deploy the mutation that is effective against minigun guys, so that you have to vary your tactics. But the first thing the developer tried was, okay, like, actually observing what the player does and countering it is a bit more code than I'm ready for, so I'm just going to initially just make them change in a random way. Every time you destroy a hive, they develop a new mutation, and we just pick a random one. And that worked great. And then eventually he got, enough time and knowledge and confidence to actually make the reactive system. And it was just brutally difficult. It was just horrible to play against. And so he ended up only using it in the last level. So the game can intelligently counteract everything you do, but it doesn't until the very last level of the game, because it's such bullshit to play against. And random is just like, random works because it does make you vary your tactics, because whatever they've changed to, it's going to affect in some way what's effective and what isn't. If you really like your strategy and it's not totally countered by what they've done, then you can carry on with it. But then every now and then you will have to change. And, pure random can be better than intelligent.
It's funny, we talk about how we want our AI to be better and why isn't AI getting better, and we don't actually want it to be better in that sense. What we want are things that are quite hard to define, like that feeling of screwing someone over in a game of Rainbow Six, like a real human being on the other end of the game. That's what we want, really. We don't want an Ubermensch that just destroys you as soon as you try and play a game, you know?
So the AI isn't the zombies, the AI is the director, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. I think in multiplayer games as well, you could make an AI that, passed a Turing test for a given multiplayer game where you couldn't tell that it wasn't a player, and it still wouldn't be as good as playing against players if you knew it was AI. If you tell the player that it's AI, then killing them isn't as satisfying, losing to them isn't as personal, and you think you see patterns where maybe there aren't patterns, and all that stuff.
You're not going to try and tell it jokes during a pause session. It's not as meaningful when you use their ability against them because you know that they don't really care.
Yeah, exactly.
We have an extra set of emails to contend with this month because obviously last month we video recorded our podcast with an actual camera in which you can see our faces. And at a certain point during our recording, I drew a penis on a piece of paper, and we have this festive competition to select the exact timestamp at which this occurred. A spot the jingle balls competition, if you will.
I got my whole family to do it at Christmas.
Did you? Family fun, that's what it is. So Ruth wrote in with five different guesses. She says, I realize that this counts as multiple guesses, but I really want to win. Fortunately, none of them were correct. And you also sort of cheated.
I like that justification. I know I'm cheating here, but I really want to win, so it's okay.
I think a person on the internet guessed two different timestamps. And he's sort of right, because I think that's when I first started drawing the cock. But it was not complete until later. So I think that probably doesn't count either.
So what do they have to say? The exact start and end time of the cock drawing?
Well, I think the completion... Well, this is the thing. We didn't specify completion. But I think that's what was implied, implicit. Connie also made a guess, but chose a much later point in the podcast than they actually could. Chronotherm got it right at 23 and 16 seconds in the video. He knows this because Chris and Marsh lock eyes.
Overdrawn
does some doodling. I think that's the time. I will have to check with Chris. We have it officially ratified, but I think Chronotherm has won Spot the Jingle Balls competition 2015.
Wow. What a turnout. What drama.
And that's all the balls that we have time for this evening. If you'd like to send us more questions, you can do so by emailing us at questions@creatingcrowbar.com. Or you can go to our forums at creatingcrowbar.com/forum or join our Discord channel, the link for which can be found in the sidebar at creatingcrowbar.com. Or you can tweet us individually at creatingcrowbar.
Wait, that's...
No, hang on. That's the opposite of individually.
You can tweet at us at creatingcrowbar or you can tweet us individually.
That is how I meant to say it.
What are you, Marsh?
I'm Marsh Davis, D-A-V-I-E-S.
I'm at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
I'm at M-T-R-C, that's M-T-R-C.
But how do you spell it? That's less nobody! Did that solo this time.
My beauty's in place. My beauty's in place. Yeah, yeah, dear. My beauty's in place.